We'll start off now with the podcast. So just to let you know, anything you say after this point, up until I press this button. Yes, exactly. So to our podcast folks, welcome here. We unfortunately weren't able to live stream today, but I hope for those who want to, you can catch up later. My name is Judy Heppner. I'm one of the people on leadership here at the table, and our pastor Tim Plett is off on holidays right now. Very well deserved. So for a few weeks in summer, some of us are filling in with some thoughts of our own. Today, I'm just going to share with you some of my musings I've had of late. I listen to a lot of things, I read a lot of things, and then sometimes I start to connect those things with, well, how does this all work with a life of faith? And so, starting off, I've been thinking a lot about the importance of community lately. What does it mean to be part of a community? Why is it important? What makes and breaks communities? What forms them, makes them healthy or unhealthy, or causes people to want to be there or not want to be there, or even makes them dissolve? And the first 2 decades of my life were actually spent in a literal small community geographically, but I think there was a strong sense of community. So going into my adult life, moving from small town to city, and just then seeing how society evolves and changes over time, I really found that I see this dearth of community. And it's certainly not something that's not just about me. I think me being a social worker, I definitely see it a lot, because usually the type of people I encounter in my work are more likely to be people who don't have strong relationships. And so I'm conscious of the fact that, is this just because of the kind of work I do? But when I look on the whole, I see research that is going into this area. I recently saw a stat that said Americans without any friends have increased 400% since 1990. And the National Institute on Aging says that having no friends is worse for health than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Loneliness is something, and I think Tim Plett may have mentioned this at 1.2, that the UK actually has a minister of loneliness. They have found that this problem of not being part of relationships beyond ourselves, having a sense of community, is really impacting people. And it was actually over 20 years ago, that Robert Putnam, who is, I think, a sociologist, put out a book called Bowling Alone. So this is he goes into the evidence, making an academic case for people. There's a decline in people taking part in civic organizations and the effects that have on us. So again, this is over 20 years ago that this decline started to be noticed. One of the things that seems to affect our ability to have these relationships that we need with other people is political polarization. There's some academics by the name of Thomas Carruthers and Andrew Donahue study this as not just a North American phenomenon, but a global phenomenon. And they researched countries throughout the world. They researched Bangladesh, Brazil, Colombia, India, Indonesia, Kenya, Poland, Turkey, and the United States. And they found that leaders are, in all of these places, were constantly taking actions that were stoking flames against political opponents. They were finding that media, especially social media, is used to grow these divisions, and that the informal norms of tolerance and moderation stop being upheld. I just have a thought, so I'm going off notes here. But this, I didn't think of this at the time I was writing, but I'm just now remembering. I don't know where I saw this information, but somebody was using the U.S. Government as an example. They said there was a time, maybe 30, 40 years ago, where you would see in Washington, D.C., just informal times, like barbecues, things like that, where Republicans and Democrats would get together. They would socialize. They would be with each other. And they said that actually changed over time. And now you see none of this goodwill socialization between members of opposite parties within government. So at the level of ordinary person, there seems to be this growing mistrust and dislike of people who don't have the same political beliefs. And at the institutional level, people have this growing mistrust of institutions. And being as community is generally found in some kind of involvement in something bigger than ourselves, some kind of institution, whether it's formal or informal. Distrust, though, runs counter to that idea of community. And faith communities don't seem to escape this polarization trend. Sojourners, I'm not sure if you call it what, an organization, website, they used to have a magazine, but whoever they are, they're generally an organization, and they've reported on a poll that showed that more than half of Protestant churchgoers under 50 say they prefer to go to church with people who share their political views. And few adult Protestant churchgoers say they attend services with people of different political persuasion. So it seems to just be, polarization seems to be cutting across everywhere. So, lately, I heard this one podcast. A podcast I listen to regularly is Lean Out. It's by Tara Henley, a former CBC journalist, and now she's independent. And she interviewed I think he was a social psychologist by the name of Azeem Sharif. The paper was titled, "Even When Ideologies Align, People Distrust Politicized Institutions." And so in this paper, they had three studies of over 3,000 U.S. adults. And they examined these adults' attitudes towards 40 different institutions. The institutions could have been such like journalists, so not so much a paper, but just journalism as a whole. Scientists, but also some more specific organizations like the World Health Organization, the Catholic Church, Facebook. And they examine certain associations, like what do people perceive as the ideological slant of these institutions, and what is the perceived politicization. So looking at the difference between those two things, ideology, but politicization. This is what happens when you write things down and you never actually read them out loud until right before when you're speaking. But that idea of the extent to which the political values impact the work that's done. So there seems to be in our minds a difference between you can have an ideology, but it doesn't necessarily move into and then they examined that idea of public trust and willingness to defer to institutions' expertise. Something that we saw in COVID, for example, was there was a lot of distrust, say, of the CDC or the World Health Organization. So the ability to trust another an institution can have huge ramifications for us. The findings were interesting. First of all, there was more trust and deference where there was ideological similarities between the person and the institution. That makes sense. We tend to trust things that align with us. What was the surprising thing was that if institutions were perceived as politicized, there were lower trust levels, even if there was ideological alignment. Here's what they said in the report. Even left-leaning participants were less trusting and less willing to support and defer to left-leaning institutions that appeared more politicized. And even right-leaning participants were less trusting and less willing to support and defer to right-leaning institutions that appeared more politicized. So basically, the more institutions were perceived not as ideological, but as politicized, there was more distrust. So if polarization drives this lack of trust, and trust is necessary to form community, and community seems vital to our health as humans, it just begs the question for me, how do we be less politicized? And in the podcast, Henley asked Sharif about this question, and one of the things he talked about was using the scientific method as a way to address our own biases, which drive that polarization. So As I said, I'm always thinking about these kinds of things in terms of community, and being faith has been such a part of my community life. I quickly go into thinking, how does this apply? Because faith and science are thought by some to have this uneasy relationship, or a very different kind of relationship. John Polkinghorne, who is an academic in the UK, his perspective on this goes like such. I'm going to quote him here. "Science asks how things happen, but there are questions of meaning and value and purpose which science does not address. Religion asks why, and it is my belief that we can and should ask both questions about the same event." So he uses the idea of making a pot of tea. Very British thing to do. He says, "Science tells us that burning gas heats the water and makes the kettle boil. But science doesn't explain the why question. The kettle is boiling because I want to make a cup of tea. Would you like some? I don't have to choose between the answers to those questions. In fact, in order to understand the mysterious event of the boiling kettle, I need both those kinds of answers to tell me what's going on. So I need the insights of science and the insights of religion if I'm going to understand the rich and many-layered world in which we live." End quote. While I appreciate Polkinghorne's perspective, I do find it assumes that science and faith are almost completely separate, and I don't necessarily think that's true. Because within our faith context, people make truth claims that we can actually examine and we can falsify. Example of this, I've been following the work of somebody by the name of Sheila Gregoire. Her work is about addressing the beliefs and actions around human sexuality in the context of the church. She wrote a book within the last couple of years with other people called The Great Sex Rescue, and she partnered with an epidemiologist named Joanna Swatsky. They surveyed 20,000 women about their sex lives, their relationships, their upbringing, their beliefs, and all of this kind of thing. And quoting Sheila from the book, she says, "We wanted to ask the question that the Christian world has failed to ask for decades. Does our evangelical advice actually work?" So the authors examined really common beliefs from popular Christian sex books and how they correlated with women's well-being in the sexual realm of their lives. Now, I won't go into a lot of the detail, but it's probably not surprising that beliefs like all men struggle with lust and that women are obligated to have sex with their husbands negatively correlate with having satisfying relationships, sexual and otherwise. So just an example of, I think there are ways in which faith makes statements that can be examined through the eyes of science. Most of us, however, are probably not going to do a lot of that kind of research. So why am I talking about the scientific method? Because I did start to wonder if it can have value for individuals in terms of confronting the kind of biases in our own lives that can lead to polarization. If we want the kind of institutions that can self-correct and not get bogged down in ideology, we might want to pay attention to a method that's designed to help us confront our own biases. So, in terms of the scientific method, we've got basically a few steps: observation, question, hypothesis, experiment, analysis, and conclusion. In terms of observation, we are always taking in data. Our senses are bringing that to us constantly. And one of the keys is to be able to understand the difference between an observation, an interpretation, and our emotional reactions. We confuse these all the time. I was going to show you, actually, I guess I still, no, I can't. Sorry, it'd just take too long. I had a slide prepared where I showed the cognitive behavior therapy triangle, which talks about that we all have situations in our lives that impact upon, that we have thoughts about, which interpret those situations. We have emotions and responses that are connected to those thoughts that we have. And I remember once, even not a client, but a coworker who herself was a social worker, who came to me once because she had been really disturbed by something another coworker had said. Just for the sake of, I'm going to make up names for these people. Susan came to me to discuss what Julie had said at a staff meeting. And in that staff meeting, she thought Julie had been really disrespectful for her. But In Susan's mind, that was an observation. Whereas in my mind, no, the observation was Julie said, da, 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 da. Your interpretation of that is that that was disrespectful. She meant to be disrespectful. And Susan described even her emotions as being disrespected. But again, that's not an emotion. It was an interpretation. And her emotion, that hurt, depending on the belief that Julie had intentionally disrespected here. So for me here, the key for using the idea of observation of the scientific method in confronting our own biases is to be clear on what our observation is as opposed to our interpretation, and to not confuse the two. Second step within the scientific method would be to question. And the scientific method can teach us to ask questions rather than to immediately jump to assumptions. At the very beginning, we can start to let go of certainty and actually do that work of exploration, which I think that's what we've said we want to do here at the table. Next step within the scientific method would be hypothesis. We actually form... Hi, welcome here. We actually... No, not today. And we also got locked out of the space, so that's why we're up here.
We got locked out of the room.
So we pivoted and came into this area. So in terms of hypothesis, we form a theory of what's going on. And in the scientific method, the hypothesis that we form, we deliberately form it as something we can disprove. Because more often we can disprove something than we can prove it. And in faith, I believe we can be really reluctant to form hypotheses. Again, somebody I follow online, I don't know who this person is. I don't know if he's a social psychologist or things like that. He just simply goes as Gerwinder. But I really liked a quote of his here. Many don't have an opinion until they're asked for it. At which point they cobble together a viewpoint from whim and half-remembered hearsay before deciding that this two-minute-old makeshift opinion will be their new hill to die on. It takes a level of thoughtfulness to be able to say, I don't know, and not form an opinion, to just leave things as a hypothesis. I think even people tried to get Jesus to go political. Do you remember that story where they said, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar? And the people who were asking him that knew that no matter what he answered, either way, it would anger about half the crowd. And he said, just give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's, which is a total non-answer. It really, it didn't buy into the idea that I have to have an opinion here. And I think what hypothesis teaches us within the scientific method is that we don't have to have an opinion on everything. There is complexity that we miss by taking a side, and it's okay to just keep the complex as the complex. Next level scientific method, experiment. Most of us are probably unlikely to do controlled experiments with our faith, but I do wonder if some of us basically end up encountering what's called natural experiments. Natural experiments are sometimes all we have, even within the scientific method, because sometimes ethically we can't do experiments. Like, think about all the learning that has come through the years about exposing unborn babies to alcohol and fetal alcohol spectrum. That did not come about because, okay, we're going to divide these women into two groups. We're going to give you lots of alcohol, and we're not going to give you any alcohol, and then we're going to compare what happened to you. We didn't do that. We had a natural experiment because some women drink alcohol. And by going backwards in time and trying to get their recollections of alcohol exposure and things like that, that's how we've pulled out this thing. This learning around FASD. COVID was also an instance where a lot of natural experiments became possible, because now people are comparing places that locked down and places that didn't, places that mandated masks sooner and people that mandated masks later, children that stayed in school and those that went online. We have tons of natural experiments that have resulted. And I think our lives, in a way, are a bit of a natural experiment. We are sometimes taking actions based on our faith, having certain expectations, and then it does or it doesn't work out. And do we have the courage to admit when we found out that our hypothesis actually countered reality? On an actual level of actual evaluation, I once saw, because of my practicum I had early in my social work career when I was still taking my BSW, I was part of a meeting where a provincial health program was being evaluated, and a lot of resources, money and people-wise, had been poured into this program, and they were finally getting back the first data from the evaluation of the program. And I watched as they were presenting data that did not show that the program did what it was designed to do. And guess how fast the excuses came? There's a possibility that this result came because people were more aware of I don't want to give away too many details because, I'd just rather keep it a secret what program it was and things like that. But the interesting part for me was just the reluctance of everybody in the room to face what seemed to me to be an obvious conclusion as maybe our program doesn't work. And again, I mentioned Sheila Ray Gregoire, the author who has done all this research around human sexuality in the evangelical church. The kickback she receives is incredible. Like, how many people, without even reading her, throw accusations of her at her. So we have a lot of reluctance to face our own beliefs, our own hypothesis, and to come to a conclusion that maybe things are not as they are. Next step, scientific method, analysis. Within analysis, some of the things that science would look at is, are the results generalizable? Like, we see something happen here, but would we see it happen if it was elsewhere? For example, you in the scientific literature, for example, you do see case studies. Like, let's write a paper about this one person who had this unusual condition and see what we can find out about that. But a good researcher will not make a generalized statement about it as, well, we saw this in one person, so we see it in everybody. I mean, can you imagine if somebody did this in our context, for example? So, say some researcher wanted to come interview members of the table and ask beliefs about our beliefs about God, whether or not God exists, whether or not there's something to female and male representations of God, all sorts of things. I mean, if any researcher took what they got from this table and said, okay, so this is what the church in Canada believes, it would be wildly inaccurate. We need to have a little bit more of an idea of, like, sample size and whether or not the sample characteristics are similar to, the society at large or the world at large. It's something that's even been pointed out in by some people in terms of how we do psychology research, sociology research. It's almost all on university students because that is the people who they have the most access to in academia where this research is being done. And they've used the acronym WEIRD to describe this. It stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And just pointing out the rest of the world is not necessarily that. So saying, we found this in a bunch of university students, so this is how human psychology is, might not be accurate. So just because my life experiment worked out in a certain way does not mean that everybody else's will. We're in a time where we hear a lot about lived experience and my truth, and we may indeed have had experiences that have given us different experiences and different perspectives. But within that, we need to acknowledge our biases. And that if this is my lived experience and my truth, we should be really hesitant about claiming it as something that all people should be believing or living. There can be a lot of different reasons for the results we see in our own lives that line up with what we see in the scientific literature as well. Placebo effect is, you know, something that happened. I prayed and something happened in my life. Well, is that actually a placebo effect that my belief actually encouraged my brain to operate differently? People often improve over time. Cause and effect isn't always clear, and what we saw might have another cause. Even in research, there are always variables that can't be controlled, and good researchers will reflect on that analysis and that uncertainty. They will keep uncertainty rather than trying to move to certainty. So in terms of then when scientists draw conclusions, the best science leaves room. If you ever hear someone say the science is settled, they don't understand science. Science is always open to the idea that future data might shed light on a subject. I do not understand the whole realm of, say, quarks, but my understanding is enough that this new data totally skewed people's understanding of how the physical world operates. And there was enough room within the scientific community to say, oh, we might be wrong. I recently heard the story, and I wish I remembered where I heard it, because I usually like to be able to give credit where credit is due. But the story was about an observation of a debate that happened between an older scientist and a younger scientist. As older scientist had basically devoted his life to a certain theory, a certain way, and he was always trying to find research to be able to substantiate this theory. And in this debate, a younger scientist came along with new data he did not know about that basically blew his life work out of the water. And his response after the debate was to go over and shake the guy's hand and thank him. Because his desire was always to know truth. And he thought he was going along the right way. But when he realized that there was data that disproved him, he was willing to accept it. So care can be taken to only make conclusions that are fair to say given all we know, such as, is this just an anecdote? I heard the phrase anecdata the other day, that, you know, back to observation. Our observations are data. They are valid, but it's often the interpretation and the conclusions about that that make it we make us say more than is worth saying, more than is probably accurate. Is this generalizable to a larger population, or is this really just about me? And are there other possibilities that can explain what we observed? So I started off with the ideas of community, and that one of the things that appears to build trust in institutions is if we remain non-ideological, if we can be open to ideas. And so then I proceeded on to just discuss the scientific method and how I see ways it could be relevant in the realm of faith to use the ability to question ourselves and our own biases, similar to how science does, to help us not to become polarized people.